طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, a discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This morning we feature Scott Ritter, a former U.S. Marine intelligence officer and U.N. weapons inspector, who gives an interesting military perspective on the war on Gaza. How prepared is the Israeli military to conduct a ground war and achieve the goal of eliminating Hamas, as they have promised to do? What is the strategy and interests of the United States as we enter a new phase of the Israel-Palestine struggle? Ritter speaks with knowledge of the Middle East in history and politics, and has much experience in the area. Here is Scott Ritter's take on the crisis in Gaza.
Israel does not want a Palestinian state, never has, right. Won't tolerate it. They've talked about it, but they knew they were never going to allow it to happen. And one of the ways they prevented it from happening was to create a division within Palestinian population. So they promoted Hamas, they funneled money into Hamas, they openly collaborated with Hamas, even though I don't think Hamas understood they were being collaborated with, and they empowered Hamas. The United States is looking at a bigger picture, and the bigger picture, it requires stability in the Middle East. In order to do that, we need Saudi Arabia on our side. We need Iran to be pacified. We need the Arab world to be doing what we want it to do. That is our big picture. And we're not going to let Israel get in the way. It has eliminated the one major obstacle to peace in the Middle East, and that is Israeli intransigence about a Palestinian state. That's gone. There will be a Palestinian state. Israel has no choice but to accept this. It will be dictated to them by the United States, by the international community, because the international community is turning on Israel as we speak. As I said, you can only drop so many bombs on a helpless civilian population before people call you out for being the war criminals that you are. So I think going forward, we're going to be seeing a different Israel, and this is the game changer.
When Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, the U.S. government quickly responded that we stand with Israel and will do anything to support our ally. But fast forward a couple weeks, and the future of the Israel-Palestine relationship looks very different. It started with President Obama warning some of Israel's actions in Gaza may backfire. The former president went on to state, "The Israeli government's decision to cut off food, water, and electricity to a captive civilian population threatens not only to worsen a growing humanitarian crisis, it could further harden Palestinian attitudes for generations, erode global support for Israel, play into the hands of Israel's enemies, and undermine long-term efforts to achieve peace and stability in the region." President Biden followed with a bold statement of his own and told the world, "When this crisis is over, there has to be a vision of what comes next, and in our view, it has to be a two-state solution." Now, to help us truly understand the next phase of this conflict and what the future of Israel and Palestine really looks like, I'm welcoming in former UN Weapons Security Inspector Scott Ritter into today's show. In our interview, we discussed the complex history of Israel and Palestine, the rise of Hamas, and why the October 7th attacks just might be the catalyst to finally establishing peace in the region. If you truly want to have a better insight into the Israel-Palestine conflict, this is the interview you need to watch. Let's begin. Everyone, I'm very honored to welcome back into the studio Scott Ritter. Scott, we had a fantastic chat the first time, obviously talking about Russia and Ukraine, but things have shifted now, and this is a much bigger conflict given the global implications, and I think also the U.S. involvement. Obviously, Israel is a very strategic ally of the United States. Scott, I wanted to bring you in again to give everybody your insights and your detailed knowledge of Israel and Palestine, this conflict that has lasted for many, many decades. And I really want to get your assessment on the situation, because I think at one point in your career, you were a very big supporter of Israel, But I think that's obviously or certainly shifted now recently. So just please open up and let everybody know your initial thoughts on, you know, this conflict and where we are today.
Well, first of all, I think we need to acknowledge that this is a conflict that didn't just begin on October 7th, although that's the day that Hamas breached this wall that Israel had built surrounding Gaza. And I think we need to just reflect on this for a while. Gaza is an open air concentration camp. Now, some Israelis might take umbrage at that. I don't care. It's time to just call things as they are. It's an open air concentration camp where 2 point something million Palestinians who are being denied any possibility of a normal life by the Israeli occupier or oppressor. You know, they have been locked in there by the Israeli government. They're denied the ability to have an airport. They're denied the ability to have a port. Entrance and exiting there is tightly controlled by foreigners. The Palestinians don't have a right to dictate the terms of their own life. And life inside Gaza is extraordinarily unpleasant. It's poverty stricken. There's no real hope for bettering one's existence. And so this has been going on for some time now. I mean, Gaza became an open air prison almost immediately after Israel became a nation in 1948. If you study the the events of that time, the Israelis had a policy of depopulating the Palestinian lands, the territories that were populated by Palestinian people, either killing them, and they killed thousands of them, or driving them out. And 700 plus thousand were ethnically cleansed in this manner, many of which were of them were sent to Gaza, right. The first installation is an open air prison. And since that time, there's been ebbing and flowing in terms of Israel and Gaza, et cetera. But recently it has become a sticky point because Hamas, this organization, it labels itself a resistance organization. Israel, the United States, Europe, and others labeled it a terrorist organization. We just need to reflect that Samuel Adams and the Sons of Liberty were called terrorists by the British back before the, in the time of the American Revolution. Menachem Begin was a member of the Irgun organization that blew up the King David Hotel in, killing hundreds of British, not just soldiers, but women, children. It was a terrorist organization, but the Israelis labeled them as freedom fighters. So depends on your perspective. I would imagine that for the vast majority of the people living inside Gaza and many of the Arabs around the world, they don't view Hamas as a terrorist organization. We know that Recep Erdogan, the president of Turkey, certainly doesn't. He just gave a speech where he called them freedom fighters, mujahideen, people fighting for the cause of resistance against Israel. But, basically the Palestinian people in recent times had their aspirations for nationhood put on the back burner. Some would even say that it's been taken off the stove altogether. The Abrams Accord, which is a Trump-era agreement seeking to normalize relations between Israel and the Arab world, was predicated on the notion that Israel would, work toward some form of Palestinian statehood. But it's lip service only. The reality of the Abrams Accord is they just steal more land from the Palestinians. It's unacceptable. But because Israel was making good with the Arab world, they had normalized relations with the United Arab Emirates, with Bahrain and others, and they were on the verge of normalizing relations with Saudi Arabia, which would have been a very big deal. The issue of Palestinian statehood had been pushed to the side. Now, because of what Hamas has done, it is the only issue on the table today. There's no talk. In fact, Joe Biden just gave a speech today alongside the Australian Prime Minister who's visiting, where he said there can be no return to the status quo ante that existed prior to October 7th, that in addition to resolving the Hamas-Israeli conflict, there must be a resolution of the Palestinian state issue. Saudi Arabia has made it clear there will be no normalization of relations with Israel until the issue of a Palestinian state has been solved. So say what you want about Hamas's actions. It has, in the long term, from a strategic perspective, done more to push forward the issue of Palestinian statehood than anything else out there, at least in theory. I mean, proof is always in the pudding and we don't know what's going on. But so that's this larger geopolitical aspect of it. I think the geopolitics of the Middle East will be shaped by the issue of Palestinian statehood and everything that accrues with that. There's also the issue of military conflict. Israel was humiliated on October 7th. The level of humiliation has yet to be acknowledged by Israel and comprehended by the world. But let me just put it this way. Israel is exposed as being a military that's incompetent, an intelligence organization that's not as good as everybody thought, and they were outfought by Hamas in the early hours of October 7th. But Scott, they took Israel by surprise. The whole purpose of the wall and the way Israel has postured its forces around Gaza is that they will never be taken by surprise. It is a permanent surveillance system. Hamas beat it, crushed it, destroyed it, humiliated Israel. And now Israel, in this humiliation, is seeking revenge. And one of the problems with the revenge is that, one, Israel doesn't have the ability to, I mean, there's that famous scene in the movie Top Gun where Maverick is being chewed out by the commander of the air group, CAG. And he says, son, your body's writing check, or your mouth's writing checks, your body can't CAG, something of that nature. Right. Well, this is happening in Israel. You have a lot of disgraced, and I need to remind everybody, every single Israeli politician and general who speaks publicly today about this issue is a disgraced individual. We wouldn't be in this situation had they done their job. These are failed politicians, failed military leaders. So when they stand before you and speak in a very aggressive manner, just remember, they got beat on October 7th. Their job was to prevent that from happening, and they didn't do that. So now when you hear them thumping their chest and saying, we're going to exact revenge, take it with a grain of salt, because these people have proven their incompetence. Israel has mobilized over 300,000 reservists. Let's be clear who these reservists are. They are not combat-hardened troops. These are troops with a very minimal level of military training, and even the training they got was never used to full effect. Then they left the military. There's been no follow-on training. Now they're called back up, and they're being asked to go into the most difficult kind of warfare imaginable, urban warfare. And not just in a city, but a city that's been destroyed. Anybody who knows anything about urban warfare, you can track it from Stalingrad, you know, through Monte Cassino to Bakhmut and Mariupol. When our experience in Mosul, when you blow up a city, you've made the job of defending the city that much easier, and you've made the job of attacking that much more difficult. And also keep in mind this, Hamas carried out a flawless attack on October 7th. It was professionally planned and executed. They didn't do that without having an endgame, meaning that everything they did, from destroying the Israeli military capacity to kidnapping people and bringing them back into Gaza, was designed to enrage Israel so that Israel stops thinking rationally, and B, lure Israel into Gaza, knowing that the Israeli Air Force would bomb. Every bomb that hits Gaza is not killing Hamas. It's killing innocent Palestinians. Hamas is well below ground, not being impacted by these bombs, because they thought about it beforehand. They know the weapon. They know it's, you know, what its effects are on the ground, and they've brought that in. The Israeli army right now is scared to death. These reservists don't have the training. They're scared to death. If they go in, they will be slaughtered. If they go in also, it's likely they will trigger a larger regional conflict. Hezbollah in the north has said they don't want to get involved in this, but if Israel keeps slaughtering the Palestinian people, which they have, over 6,500 dead, over 1,000 of them are children, have been killed by the Israeli indiscriminate bombing, Hezbollah said they will intervene. And let's keep in mind, Hezbollah, until Hamas's victory on October 7th, Hezbollah was the only Arab force that actually beat the Israelis in a stand-up fight.
So, Scott, I have a question. I mean, I think the attack from Hamas is a brutal attack, against innocent Israelis. And I think what we've seen is a huge outcry from, you know, certainly the Western world, the United States and our allies, everyone standing very clearly with Israel. I mean, would you agree with this? Is that the rise of Hamas, I mean, they were democratically elected in 2006. Do you think that the reason for them being elected is simply the fact that these Palestinians felt no other option was left for them? The fact that they just didn't have a future, and so that they would resort to something of this extremism? I mean, I'm certainly under the belief that Hamas is definitely closer to a terrorist organization than a legitimate, you know, freedom fighter. But I mean, certainly carrying out those attacks. But I can also understand that probably the conditions that Israel created for Palestine is the exact breeding grounds for an organization like Hamas to be democratically elected and to, you know, go carry out those attacks.
So I am not going to accept the idea that Hamas on October 7th was a terrorist organization. They were carrying out a military assault, and they carried out with far more precision and far less collateral damage than what Israel's doing. If you're going to call Hamas a terrorist organization, then every single Israeli pilot that flies over Gaza today and indiscriminately drops bombs that have killed 6,500 Palestinian civilians, over 1,000 of whom are children, then they are terrorists. And if they're terrorists, everybody wears the green of the IDF as a terrorist, and every Israeli politician is a terrorist. And I think think it's more accurate to call Israel the terrorist entity in this case than it is to say Hamas. The history of Hamas and the formation of Hamas is complex. They come from a Muslim extremist foundation. The Muslim Brotherhood is their ideological base. Unlike the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which is more secular in nature, Hamas is definitely very much fundamentalist in terms of their religious beliefs. The Israelis have been fostering Hamas from the very beginning. I mean, Hamas, you know, was conceived by the Palestinians as its own thing. But it was the Israeli government that said, hey, this we can use. You right. see, Israel didn't want the Palestinian Liberation Army, or PLO, to become this powerful entity, because the last thing Israel wants is a viable Palestinian state. I'll say that one more time, just so people understand what I'm saying. Israel does not want a Palestinian state, never has, right. won't tolerate it. They've talked about it, but they knew they were never going to allow it to happen. And one of the ways they prevented it from happening was to create a division within Palestinian population. So they promoted Hamas, they funneled money into Hamas, they openly collaborated with Hamas, even though I don't think Hamas understood they were being collaborated with, and they empowered Hamas. All the terrorist acts that took place in the 1990s took place because Israel wanted them to take place. I'm not saying they planned them. What I am saying is that Israel viewed that as a very effective way of not only dividing the Palestinian population, but then demonizing them in the eyes of the world so that there wouldn't be a Palestinian state. You see, if Hamas is around blowing up buses and bridges, no one's going to support a Palestinian state because everybody has bought into the notion that Israeli security must come first. Israel was facilitating the acts of terror that took place against them by creating the organization that produced the terrorists. That doesn't mean that Israel wasn't hunting them down and killing them. Of course they were. I'm just saying that Israel's not an innocent party here. Benjamin Netanyahu is not an innocent party. In 2005, they made a decision to transition from a terrorist organization. Israel made the decision to transition Hamas from a terrorist organization into a political organization. They coordinate with the Qatari government to pour in millions of dollars to turn Hamas into a political party, and then they helped facilitate them in elections that Hamas won, by the way. Hamas won the majority of seats in the Palestinian parliament. And then what happened is Israel, I think, was a little taken aback. They wanted a little party. They didn't want a big party. So they then facilitated a civil war between Fatah, the military wing of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and Hamas. Hamas had a significant representation in the West Bank, a very strong representation in Gaza. When the civil war ended, Fatah had been totally eliminated in Gaza, and Hamas had been kicked out of the West Bank. So Gaza became a Hamas stronghold. And from 2007 onwards, Hamas has run the show. There are other resistance groups. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad is one that's well known, but the biggest and the most influential is Hamas, and they're running the show there. Now, they have a job of governance, and they are doing that, but they've never forgotten their resistance roots. I again ask everybody just to reflect on the reality that Gaza is an open air concentration camp. If you lived in an open air concentration camp, tell me what you would do. And if you say, I would sit there and do nothing, you're a liar. Every single man worthy of the name would wake up every morning saying, how do I hurt them? Hurt the occupiers, hurt the people that have pinned me in. And they would be very receptive to the message of resistance that comes from Hamas. So, right. you know, now we come back to things that Joe Biden has said. The only solution to this problem, the only solution, is the creation of a Palestinian state. If you want to defeat Hamas, and the only way you're going to defeat Hamas, you have to create a Palestinian state that defuses Hamas's reason to exist. Hamas exists to resist Israel. Right. But if there is a Palestinian state, there's really nothing left to resist. And right. so Hamas will go away.
Right. I think I was reading a very good New York Times article where one of the comments on that article was that Hamas really represents an ideology more than it does a group of people. Right. And I guess you're basically concluding that same
thing.
And
how do you kill an ideology?
Right. You replace it with what they want or with something that's better than them.
But how do you not kill an ideology?
Well, then you continue
dropping bombs, killing people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, I think that is well documented as well, that Israel certainly, this has certainly backfired on Israel's plan then, right? Because like you just mentioned, it has been well documented that Israel actually has supported Hamas over the years, mainly to create that division. So for those of you that aren't clear, you know, Hamas does have the stronghold in Gaza, but there are many Palestinians in Gaza and, you know, more on the West Bank that oppose Hamas. So it is, you know, creating this internal division, right? It's not a united Palestinian front. So it was really a move from Israel and certainly Netanyahu to support Hamas in the sense of now you've broken up the support in Palestine. It's not a united front. Therefore, they won't be moving towards statehood. And that has seemed to now backfire, obviously, because of these attacks that were carried out on October 7th. Scott, I've got an interesting thing I want to shift to, because there is a new article that was just written in the Financial Times. I'm going to bring it up here, is that fears grow that Israel has no plan agreed for a post-war Gaza. And when we read this article, it says the lack of an exit plan is one factor in the delays to the Gaza ground operation that has been long threatened by Benjamin Netanyahu's government. There is no plan for the day after. And this is the quote from the article that really stands out, as the Americans went crazy when they realized there was no plan. So I want to talk to you about this specifically because, you know, initially, I think it was on October 9th or 10th, maybe, you know, a couple of days after, Netanyahu sent out a very clear message. He said, you know, northern Gaza, 1.1 million people, you have 24 hours to evacuate, move into southern Gaza, we're coming in. Obviously, at the time, that was an impossible request, right? There's no way they could move a million people in less than 24 hours. And there was a huge concern, right, that all of a sudden, you know, potentially a million people are going to get caught in these crossfires. It's now been almost 2 weeks. We haven't seen Israel, you know, make this move yet. And I think now we're starting to see a little bit of pushback from the Americans saying, you know, what is the eventual plan here? You know, I mean, are you going to move forward with this? So I want to kind of get your thoughts on this as far as, you know, does the ground invasion happen? If they are to be moved from northern Gaza for this ground invasion, this is the innocent civilians we're talking about, you know, where do they go? You know, I mean, there's only one place that kind of makes sense, I guess, at least from the Israeli side, is they're saying they could potentially go to the Sinai Peninsula, which is basically just a vast open desert. So I want to get your thoughts on this next phase here and what's now happening as Israel potential ground invasion is just a few days away. And, you know, what's really going to happen next?
Well, first of all, I just want to set the stage. Everything we're talking about is a war crime. Let's just be straight up honest about this. The concept of demanding that a million people leave their homes and move is a war crime. It's collective punishment. It's against the law. So anybody who sits there and says, you know, well, you know, we should consider, you're no better than the Nazis. You're no better than any war criminal that's ever existed. The fact that Israel is allowed to articulate this policy and not be held to account is stunning. The concept of collective punishment, which Israel has codified as official doctrine since 2006, is called the Dahua Doctrine, mowing the grass, is a war crime, a literal war crime. It's collective punishment. But nobody's saying anything. Everybody's just sitting there going, well, it's Israel. It's the Palestinians. It's normal. I guess it's normal for Israel to commit war crimes against Palestinians because they do on a daily basis. Everything Israel is doing in this conflict is a war crime. So right off the bat, we can't legitimize a war crime by saying, well, I mean, those million people got to move. No, they don't. Those million people can't move and they're not going to move. No one's going to open up the gates. They're not going to the Sinai. The tragic reality is those million people will die before they move. And now the question is, how much death will the world tolerate before they step in and tell Israel, enough is enough, you're done? Israel will not launch a ground incursion, a large-scale ground incursion into Gaza. They can't do it. There's American military teams right now telling them, you can't. I mean, again, the question is, it's not just a political endgame, it's a military endgame. You go into Gaza and then what? They don't have a plan. Remember, Israel was taken by surprise on October 7th. So everything that's happening right now is basically a plan they're making up on the spot. Right. They're making it up. They've done two major military exercises recently. One, Chariots of Fire last year, this year, Firm Hand. All of them were what we call stress tests. They were stress testing the entire Israeli military establishment, premised on the notion that everything went bad at once, meaning Gaza, Hamas, West Bank, Palestinian Liberation Organization, Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran. First of all, each time Israel was swamped. They couldn't handle it. But the other thing about the stress test is they never considered this. Under no circumstances in the stress test did they ever say, okay, part of the Israeli response will be to mobilize 300,000 Israeli reserves and send them to Gaza. Right. The reserves were mobilized and sent to Lebanon to fight Hezbollah. Gaza and the West Bank were considered to be police actions against militants, against terrorists, but not an outright war. So whatever war plan Israel had has been shredded, thrown away, and they're making it up as they go along, which means they don't have a clue what they're doing. And that's what's driving the Americans crazy, because Israel's saying, we're going to go into Gaza. And America's saying, wait, what's your plan?
Right.
What are you going to do, Israel, now that you locked in 300,000 troops to Gaza when Hezbollah comes across the border up north? Right. Because in your real war plan, which we coordinated with you, you had most of your forces up there. And I tend to believe in the war game, you lost because Hezbollah has all these missiles. They swamped your air defense. They blew up your cities. They blew up your military bases and they seized northern Israel. So now you won't have any forces up there. And if you take a look at what's happening right now, the Israeli armor units up there, they're almost in revolt because Hezbollah is picking their tanks off one by one by one. I think it's 22 Merkava tanks have been blown up so far. And when I say blown up, that means dead crew members. You know, Hezbollah is suffering casualties too. Israel's responding back. But my point is, this is not an invincible Israeli army. Right. This is an army that Hezbollah has been studying to fight for, you know, continuously since 2006 when they last beat Israel. You know, Israel's army today is an army of soft people who join. They don't train hard. I mean, you're getting reservists, generals coming in saying they don't know how to clean their weapons. They're not motivated. These guys would give them equipment. They don't wear it right. They're not in physical condition. I was talking to a Russian colonel that was talking about urban warfare, the Russian lessons from Mariupol and Bakhmut. And he said, you know, the first thing is you have to be extraordinarily fit to do this.
Right.
Because you're wearing around 50, 60 pounds worth of combat kit.
Right.
And if you're not wearing it, you're going to die because you're going to get hit in the head. You're going to get hit in the chest. You're going to get hit in the groin, in the back. And if you're not wearing his gear, you're dead. This way, you might get knocked down. You might get wounded, but at least you'll be alive. But you got to wear the gear. He said, in running across, because you don't walk, running from point A to point B, constantly getting up, getting down. He says, if you're not training for this, you're in trouble. He said, we had to take our units and go out. In addition to training on tactics, we had to get them physically fit. They had to be used to wearing this stuff. The reservists right now, these are fat donut eating boys and girls. They're not well fit. They're going to exhaust themselves. They're going to go across into Gaza and they're going to drop like flies, not from Hamas fire, but just from heat exhaustion and the fact that they can't carry the weight. They're not conditioned to do it. They don't have the proper tactics. Again, the guy was saying, you know, we had to learn that you don't use SWAT tactics, you know, because everybody's plays Call of Duty and every play, you know, watches the movies. And of course, all the commandos get together at the door and then they shotgun in and they shoot the thing up. And he says, you do that, a drone comes in, drops a mortar on you, kills everybody. Right. In modern war, you're dispersed and you have to train to do that. It's a whole new mindset of dispersal, et cetera. Israel hasn't trained to do this.
Do you predict that Israel will not go in with this ground invasion? Do you think
Israel can't go in with this ground invasion? There's two reasons why. One, they're going to lose. And the Americans are telling them straight up, you're going to lose. What Israel will do is have small incursions. You'll see raids going in. Okay. But the idea of 100,000 Israeli troops lining up their tanks and going in, that isn't going to happen. Yeah. And one of the main reasons why it's not going to happen is America's saying, what do you do when Hezbollah comes across the border?
Right.
What's your plan?
Right. Because you're spread too thin. Right. You've got all the
not only that, but Hamas just wiped out Iron Dome. Iron Dome. They've shot all their ammunition. There's no ammunition left. They're begging America for more. We gave them the last 360 odd rounds we have. We've got nothing left. We're trying to produce it, but you can't produce it overnight. And, you know, there's 200,000 rockets in Hezbollah's arsenal. 200,000. Let's say Israel has 3,000 interceptors left. Hezbollah simply fires 3,000 rockets. Israel expends everything. Now they have 197,000 more that'll come in and hit Israel without any defense. Nothing.
So, Scott, you've brought up a good point here, and you know, is that a bigger threat to the North, Hezbollah. And I want to shift our strategy here and our conversation more towards Iran now, because I think there is a lot of speculation that, you know, the potential is for a bigger conflict here in the region to really erupt. And I think this is why the United States obviously immediately sent over, you know, military aircraft carriers. I mean, we've got a huge, you know, military envoy going over there right now, already there. And I think this is a very sensitive situation. Obviously, you know, when we look at the Russia-Ukraine situation, you know, Ukraine, we can say is an ally, but certainly nowhere like Israel. I mean, you know, we would never put boots on the ground in Ukraine for any matter. But I think if push comes to shove, you know, we would certainly see American troops on the ground, or we would see, you know, America rushing to do whatever it needs to do to stabilize that region. What do you feel is the biggest threat right now? I mean, do you feel that there is a big potential for a conflict between the U.S. and Iran? And what is your thoughts on the grander picture if this does not stay contained and it really erupts into a larger regional conflict? What does that look like to you?
Well, let me just start by pointing out that I think the greatest threat to Israel is actually from Hamas, not from Hezbollah, because it's Hamas that has brought the issue of a Palestinian state to the forefront. And that's the biggest threat to Israel's vision of a greater Israel. You know, it undoes decades of Israeli policy. So that's the greatest threat. Let's talk about Hezbollah real brief. Hezbollah doesn't want to fight Israel. They don't want to. Hezbollah is focused on governing in Lebanon. They're a political party in addition to having this very strong militia. But their goal right now, Lebanon is a nation that's devastated by, you know, a collapsing economy. And Hezbollah is part of the government trying to build a functioning coalition. The last thing they need is a war with Israel, where Israeli bombs level West Beirut as they did in 2006. So Hezbollah is not itching for a fight. This is why, you know, Hezbollah has said, if as long as what Israel does doesn't cross the line of tolerance, we'll stay out of this fight. And Hamas has told everybody, we got this under control, guys. We don't need you. We got this under control. And they do. They're in total control of the situation. It's callously, they don't care about the people upstairs, or they do, but they're like Charles de Gaulle. They're willing to sacrifice them for the greater good. If you asked the majority of Palestinians, if you could die, give your life for the birth of a Palestinian nation, they would say yes, because for 75 years, that's all they dreamed of. And now, thanks to Hamas, they have that possibility. Hezbollah does not want to be a part of this fight. Iran does not want to be a part of this fight. Again, Iran has met with the Hamas political leadership in Qatar, and we're told the same thing. We don't want you to intervene. We got this under control. And what's that tell you? When the Israelis say, we know that Iran gave the green light. Iran knew nothing about this. This took Iran totally by surprise, just like Hezbollah was taken by surprise. And Iran is saying, hey, guys, we just normalized relations with Saudi Arabia. Big deal. I mean, it's a huge deal. Which, by the way,
was negotiated by China.
By China.
Yeah.
We are now joining BRICS. Right. We're a member of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Our focus is economic. We are focusing on getting the economy of Iran, which has been suffering under sanctions for decades, on its feet, moving forward. The last thing Iran needs is a war. And they don't want a war. They want to avoid a war. And they have communicated this to the United States, which is another reason why the United States is telling Israel, you're not going into Gaza, guys, because nobody wants this war. You're going to lose the war. You can't win. And if you go in, you risk turning this into a regional war that nobody wants. Now, we know, if you've read Barbara Tuchman's book, The Guns of August, we know that in World War One, in the summer of 1914, nobody wanted a world war, but everybody slow walked their way to it because it was just one of these things, you know, like a slow moving traffic accident that you know is going to be horrible. And you're watching it and you're not doing anything to stop because it's inevitable. We could be on that path. Hopefully we're not. Hopefully the United States has communicated appropriately, not only with Israel, but with Hezbollah and with Iran, that we want to avoid escalation. This is why, if you noticed last night, there was a massive attack against American bases in Syria and Iraq by so-called Shia resistance forces. 24 Americans, according to the news, were wounded soldiers. One contractor died of a heart attack. Now, normally, this would be the kind of thing that would precipitate massive American counterstrike. But have you seen American bombers in the air dropping bombs? No. Why? Because this is called escalation management. Right. This is where we are going to absorb a certain amount of punishment as sort of like a safety valve. You want to bleed off this pressure, bleed it off. But what you have to ensure when you bleed off the pressure, that you're not doing anything to generate more pressure. Again, let me just make this point. For the first time in a long time, there is a chance for real peace in the Middle East, because you could never talk about genuine peace in the Middle East if it didn't include a legitimate Palestinian state. Thanks to Hamas, thanks to what Hamas did, that option is now on the table. And there's recognition by everybody that there will be no going forward, no return to the status quo without a Palestinian state being created. This is bad news for Israel, but it's good news for Israel. Israel wants security. There will never be security without a Palestinian state, because there will always be conflict.
Right.
There will always be a war. Israel somehow believes that they can make this problem go away. They haven't. The only way this problem goes away is what we talked about earlier. You create a legitimate Palestinian state. You allow the Palestinian people now to have hope based upon their own hard work to create their own nation. And you instantly delegitimized the kind of violence that Hamas is promoting. You will compel Hamas to become a political entity dedicated to the growth and prosperity of a Palestinian state, or else they will be thrust into the trash bin of history by the Palestinian people, because they have no legitimate reason to continue.
Right.
So there's now, for the first time in a long time, legitimate hope for peace in the Middle East.
Do you think that, now I would imagine that Israel, and the last thing on their mind right now is establishing that legitimate state of Palestine. I mean, do you think that this is going to have to take something from like a President Biden really meeting with Netanyahu and trying to convince him? I mean, it feels that the United States is really the only country in the world that could have any type of leverage or any can really talk to Israel right now. I think we're the only country that really has any chance to sit down and communicate. I know that the situation is difficult because Netanyahu is a very far right extreme politician, and he has surrounded himself with a cabinet that is even more extreme than he is. There's also he's wanted on corruption charges. His hands are kind of tied as well because he can't do a lot of things. And I think his cabinet basically is saying, you know, we want this revenge. And now has I would almost kind of argue this point a little bit that is this not throwing the chance for statehood even further down the line? I mean, wouldn't Israel be fighting, you know, desperately to avoid that? Or is this really their only option? Is like you said, if they want security, they're going to have to establish the statehood.
Israel doesn't have a vote anymore. They got beat. Let me just make it clear.
Yeah.
When you win, you get a vote. When you're the victor, you get to dictate. But when you've been defeated, you have to listen. You have to accept. Benjamin Netanyahu is a man who, even before this October 7th attack, was on thin ice politically. You know, in order to stay in power, because as you pointed out, he's been charged with very serious corruption charges. And again, you're innocent until proven guilty. But I mean, sometimes it's very obvious that you're guilty, and he's guilty of corruption charges that will put him in jail for a very long time, not just him, but his wife. But what he's done with his Likud allies is they've taken, he was reelected. He's created a governing coalition, but he had to go far right to do it. In Israel, they don't have a constitution, but they have the basic law, which replicates that notion. And what Netanyahu has done together with his far right allies in the Knesset is they've rewritten the basic law of Israel so that the judiciary is now subordinate to the Knesset and the prime minister. So any judge that moves forward with a case against Netanyahu for corruption can be impeached. They'll just impeach him. Bam, gone. I mean, this is the kind of stuff of banana republics. This is why hundreds of thousands of Israelis took to the streets before October 7th. They were saying, we're done. The president of Israel was saying, we are very close to a civil war. And he was saying, literally, we're very close to this nation breaking apart and going to war with itself. That was the situation that existed prior to October 7th. The one thing Netanyahu had going for him was that he had convinced people that he was the security guy, that he alone could secure Israel from Iran, from Hezbollah, from Hamas. He was the man. Right. Well, he failed. October 7th is a failure.
Right.
And so now when we talk about Israel's political future, understand this. At some point in time, the generals who failed, the politicians who failed, will have to shut up. Because right now they're sucking all the oxygen out, saying terrorists. They're making stuff up. I mean, look, we can go back to the beginning of World War I and look at atrocity propaganda. You know, when the Germans marched into Belgium, they were literally accused of ripping babies out of the wombs, of beheading children, of doing raping, all this stuff. Hamas has been accused of the same thing every day. It's a standard thing. They beheaded children. They raped women. They did this. There's no evidence that they did any of that. It hasn't been presented. You might find a one example here, one example, but from a policy standpoint, in fact, there's overwhelming evidence that Hamas, being a very fundamentalist Islamic organization, they actually treat women with respect. Imagine that. All the women hostages have said they treated us with respect. They put us, they gave us medical care. Now, the people say, well, that's just propaganda, Scott. I don't know. But until you find a narrative that counters that, that's the one that we have documented, not by Hamas saying it, but by the hostages themselves, about the people that were held by Hamas. So the point I'm trying to get at is that at some point in time, the Netanyahu government is going to be held to account for what happened on October 7th, and the Israeli people will not forgive them. Everybody who died, when it becomes documented, when they do the investigation, because every one of those bodies had an autopsy done on it, There's a file in there that says bullet wound here, entry point here, exit point here. Mechanism of death is this, time of death is this, place of death is that. And when an investigator comes in and starts overlaying all that out, it's going to become clear that what the survivors of some of these kibbutzes have been saying, that it was the IDF that killed everybody, that the IDF came in and just haphazardly, without any discipline, in a total panic, fired indiscriminately, killing the hostages and Hamas alike. Then this atrocity propaganda gets flushed down the toilet. And suddenly, we're talking about criminality. It's criminality that's taken place. And the reason why I bring all this up is I don't think the Netanyahu government is going to be the government that's involved in the end game here. I think they'll be gone. I think there's going to be a new government in Israel, one that's reflective of the reality. It's going to be a government that has little or no negotiating position with the United States, because the United States is looking at a bigger picture. And the bigger picture, it requires stability in the Middle East. In order to do that, we need Saudi Arabia on our side. We need Iran to be pacified. We need the Arab world to be doing what we want it to do. That is our big picture. And we're not going to let Israel get in the way. It has eliminated the one major obstacle to peace in the Middle East, and that is Israeli intransigence about a Palestinian state. That's gone. There will be a Palestinian state. Israel has no choice but to accept this. It will be dictated to them by the United States, by the international community, because the international community is turning on Israel as we speak. As I said, you can only drop so many bombs on a helpless civilian population before people call you out for being the war criminals that you are. So I think going forward, we're going to be seeing a different Israel. And this is the game changer, because the Middle East without that isn't dominated by an Israeli oppressor or just a very powerful, assertive Israel is a Middle East that hasn't existed since, you know, the 1970s. It's going to be a wonderful thing. I believe in an Israeli state. Don't get me wrong. I believe that Israel has a right to exist, that there needs to be a Jewish homeland. I mean, the Holocaust proves that. But you can't have a homeland and expect to live in peace and security when, in order to get that homeland, you deny millions of people the right to have their own homeland, which is what Israel is doing with the Palestinians. Right. That's not how you live in peace. So I think this is compelling. Israel will have to change its parameters. I think political Zionism is going to take a big hit, yep, which is going to have the tremors that come off of that one is going to be interesting to watch. Israel will exist, should exist, must exist, and they must exist with security. But Israel has never accepted the notion of security guarantees. Israel has always said that we are responsible for our own security. I think now there's going to have to be security guarantees put in there where, you know, because Israel can't be allowed to have the military that it has right now. And frankly speaking, after this abysmal performance, the Israeli taxpayers may say we're better off by having security guarantees from abroad than this apparatus that failed us miserably. And an interesting thing is, if you start rethinking what Israeli security looks like, do they now need the Samson option? Do they need their nuclear weapons? And this could actually be the opportunity to put Israeli nuclear weapons on the table. Again, what happened on October 7th is a tragedy. I will never say otherwise. I wish they hadn't died. I wish the attacks hadn't taken place. But I think that it has opened up, it's shaken up the Middle East to the point that there is real chance, because the Middle East had become calcified around a reality dictated by Israel and imposed by Israel on others. And now that it's been shooken up, I think we have a chance for a more equitable peace, one that is, because you can be compelled to be peaceful for a little while. But at some point in time, you remember we talked about the safety valve and the pressure. Right. If you don't resolve that which creates the pressure will eventually build up. If we now, international community, can work with Israel to create a peace in the Middle East where you've eliminated that pressure cooker, we could be looking at real peace down the road. And that would be fascinating.
It would be. It would be. Well, Scott, I want to thank you for your time today. And I want to thank you for educating us all on this, because I know you've had a lot of experience, in this area of the world. And certainly, me growing up in America as a young child, is one of the things we always heard was, you know, peace in the Middle East and always. I was a young boy when it was the Gulf War, and it was just always this thing of there's never going to be peace in the Middle East. So hopefully this tragedy of October 7th does lead to that. And I like your optimism there. And I do think it's encouraging when you have leaders like Joe Biden advocating for this. And, you know, I think it's well documented as well that, you know, the American presidents going back all the way to Jimmy Carter and pretty much every president after has been, you know, trying to move this forward. I think there's some really good insights that you shared as to why America is right there. Scott, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Again, you know, great insights into Russia, Ukraine that you first shared a few weeks ago. Again, I want to thank you for your insights into Israel and Hamas and this new war. And, you know, we just pray for peace. I mean, we can pray for hopefully a solution to come soon. And we'll certainly have you back in the studio at a future time. So thank you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You have been listening to Scott Ritter's analysis of the war on Gaza. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine archive. It is all there. You can also stream us live every Monday on kkrn.org, all one word, kkrn.org, at 9 a.m. Please tune in again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, hoping you will get involved with the struggle to bring justice to the Palestinian people. Your voice is needed now. More than ever. We will talk again next week.